let's just take some enjoyment of the fact that we now have a pot stock bubble. I mean, of course we have a pot stock bubble. It's great.
It's about the journey. It's not about the destination. The destination will not be, in my opinion, a global trade war.
Yeah, President Donald Trump just announced that he's imposing 10% tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods. That's starting September 24th. Then those tariffs go up to 25% starting on January 1st. Now, 300 items have been removed from the list, the original list of $200 billion.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team. Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Well, a bubble in cannabis stocks this week. Trade wars escalate as the president follows through with $200 billion worth of tariffs. And stock buybacks could hit nearly $1 trillion, an all-time record. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in hour one, Ari Wald will join me from Oppenheimer. He still thinks this bull market has legs, and you're going to want to hear his three sectors to finish out the rest of the year. Commodities he's not too fond of and could be in trouble, but Ari also expects interest rates to rise with the next rate hike coming next week. And also later on in the program, Robert Rapier will be joining as we take a look at the oil markets. There is a new law, a maritime law that will go into effect in 2020 that's going to be driving diesel prices higher. If you thought you were going to save money by buying a diesel car because of the extra mileage, you're going to end up paying a lot more. And according to Robert, we're a long ways away from peak demand when it comes to the energy industry. It has been paying down its debt, increasing its cash flow, and there are a lot of bargains in the energy sector, from high dividend paying stocks to the mid-tiered sectors. Also on the program, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets. All of that coming up in hour one.
And I'm Chris Prytower. In hour two, The Big Picture, we're going to be discussing something that we've seen many times during this historic bull market, and that is the sudden plunge in stock prices and periodic episodes of bubbles in particular asset classes or market sectors. So we'll look at catalysts for the next bear market and recession. So be sure to stay tuned for hour two, The Big Picture. Well, it's time to get into the weeds and talk about this week's catalysts and drivers with Ryan Poplava. Ryan, with the U.S. stock market hitting all-time highs again this week and only a week left of the third quarter, things look pretty promising for risk takers right now. But can you tell us what moved the market this week?
I guess to start, Chris, I mean, how much of the weed do you really want to get into this week?
Well, it's funny you say that, Ryan, because Jim and I will be talking about the growth of pot stocks coming up on The Big Picture.
No, seriously, Chris, I'd like to focus first on the economic numbers out, because those continue to just be really strong. And I believe the main reason, coupled with earnings, that the U.S. stock market continues to plug higher without much regard for the day-to-day headlines. You know, economics continue to be strong for the U.S. with the Goldilocks jobs print a couple of weeks ago, if you remember that. And more likewise, prints of growth with low price inflation with the Philly Fed PMI, that's the Purchasing Managers Index, that hit around 22.9 in September, which is about 11 points up from last month, with new orders, shipments, and employment all higher, while the prices component remains soft. And then there was the stark contrast to that, which was the Empire Manufacturing PMI earlier this week. It ticked lower to 19, but these two have not really been in agreement with each other as of late, including August. So interesting that that's carrying on. You know, jobless claims hit a cyclical low of 201,000 last week, and that's the lowest since November 15th of 1969. Of course, that continues to track lower. Eventually, we'll be talking about maybe sub 200,000 in the weeks, months ahead, but probably not around the corner due to Florence. But anyways, the Philly Fed number was just a real driver of growth Thursday, absent any trade headlines. In combination with that low jobless claims print, really helped all of the indexes move higher. And then the LEIs, that's the leading economic indicator from, the conference board, printed below expectations. It was only up about 0.4%, but that's kind of consistent with 3% GDP growth. And I was looking at the GDP nowcast. It's still forecasting right now around 4.4% for the third quarter. So that's remained in the 4% range for some time. Housing starts have jumped around 9.2% month over month in August, probably recovering from fires this summer. And then there was the manufacturing data. When we really just look at it this week, that seems to agree with the Philly Fed survey, with the recent flash purchasing managers data from the IHS market out Friday was really showing output is cooling in September, right around to 53.4 from 54.7 in August, mainly due to the services component, which drove those things down. Manufacturing was strong. Looking closer into the report pointed towards companies really shutting down ahead of Hurricane Florence. So, Hurricane Florence is where I think we'll see quite a bit of fluctuation in the near future.
So I'm hearing about a lot of strength, Ryan, but you did bring up Hurricane Florence. Do you think we're going to see weakness ahead due to Hurricane Florence and other economic data?
Yes, like possibly the jobs report for September, but that's usually, when these types of situations, they're very temporary. Like I mentioned, for the housing starts up, really reflecting a recovery from the fires this summer, we'll likely see the same thing. And you got to remember, there's other factors. For example, last year, Hurricane Irma and Harvey both did incredible flooding damage, and that destroyed what looked to be around almost a million in cars, which, of course, led to a ramp up in car sales down the road. So hurricanes do an incredible amount of damage, but you can also see how impressive our country really is at bouncing back. And I think that's kind of tantamount to us as a people, our country, and how that when it push comes to shove, we really can work together. Trump was this week talking about rescue happening in many different facets of this. And like I said, we have the infrastructure, the rescue when it comes to things like this, and we really do bounce back very quickly.
Okay, so we've covered U.S. economics. And by the way, I don't believe any economy has been as robust as the U.S. right now. And that's probably why our dollar is so strong and money continues to flow into our markets. But let's talk about Europe. There's a couple things impacting Europe, the trade war, Brexit, and some of the currency and political issues that we've seen in Turkey and Italy. Can you speak to those issues?
Well, yeah, specifically on Brexit, there really hasn't been any new breakthrough there, although I do believe they're headed towards another summit in November, and they've agreed to that. And they've actually outlined that they want to come up with a firm groundwork at that meeting. So hopefully in November, we'll have a lot to talk about. But, the flash Eurozone Purchasing Managers Index information came out on Friday, and they were the second weakest print since late 2016 at around 54.2. But of course, anything above 50 is still growth, but it did drop slightly from 54.5 in August. Based on looking at the information, it was really on weaker growth in manufacturing. And so I looked a little closer at that IHS report, and I saw some comments from their chief economist, Chris Williamson, who said that basically, this is his quote, trade wars, Brexit, waning global demand in autos, growing risk aversion, destocking, and rising political uncertainty, both within the Eurozone and further afield, all fueled the slowdown in business activity. So services, based on the strong jobs gains, are really what's helping to offset some of that manufacturing weakness. So trade wars, tariffs. You hear when Trump talks about the EU, what does he say? He's talking about cars. He's always just talking about cars. So, that's the issue. And that's probably weighing on things right now is the uncertainty.
Now, beyond the economic update this month, what were some of the headlines that moved the market, if any?
Well, President Trump formally announced the new tariffs on China. That was he announced that earlier this week, and it will be effective next week on the 24th. And it's going to start at 10% tariffs on, of course, the same $200 billion in goods that he had mentioned before. But you remember, we were going back and forth. Is it 10%? Some were saying it's going to be 25%. Well, here's the thing. The rate will go up to 25% on January 1 of 2019. So kind of a bit in the middle, although recently, just as recently as last week, there was comments that it was just going to be 10%. So this was seen as kind of a little more hawkish than what we were hearing from last week. But Tuesday, China added 60 billion of U.S. products to its import tariff list in retaliation. But at the same time, later this week, Bloomberg mentioned that China is planning to cut the average tariff rate that it charges on imports as early as October. But at this point, it's not very clear if the U.S. will be part of that because the Chinese can select which products it lowers tariffs on. Still, we're hearing, you know, regarding North America, there's no deal yet on trade with Canada. But the trade news didn't seem to really affect things too much. The market's headed up on all that news. Pot stocks got a huge bump this week. Canada announced, if you recall, back in June, it will legalize marijuana nationally, and that's coming up October 17th. So we're heading up towards that, and Coca-Cola has mentioned talks with Canadian company to brew a CBD-infused beverage, and the Drug Enforcement Administration announced a deal with Tilray to import pot for medical research marijuana. And of course, last month, we had Constellation Brands increase its investment in Canopy Growth Corporation.
Now, Ryan, I'm glad you mentioned Tilray. The stock market action in Tilray was just crazy this week. Do you think that was a result of the DEA deal?
Partly, and that's what kind of got things started. And then, of course, Jim Cramer invited Tilray's CEO onto the show and maybe chalk it up to inexperience or whatnot. Yeah, you know, he basically hyped the industry and Tilray itself on the show. And I've been watching the stock for a few weeks now, and it saw just insane volatility this week. So much of that, I think, was attributed to that, in addition to that DEA deal. Of course, it's big for them, and it should ramp up their sales if they can in fact import that in, which, again, DEA said they can. But, you know, Jim Cramer followed up that interview on Friday, telling people that there's just too much excitement in the industry, and it will end badly. So, you know, in the office, we were just talking, I think, on Wednesday when Tilray was up like 70%. It was up to $300 a share intraday. And we were talking about its sales and how its market cap was the same as companies with 100 times those sales. So clearly, when you're looking at those kind of metrics, you've got a little bit of froth. But like Bitcoin, you know, it's really hard to pinpoint when these exact tops can come into play. So you just got to be, if you're in these areas where the volatility is and the momentum is, you got to be careful. You got to be flexible. And at the same time, I'm a huge believer, Chris, in the growth of the industry. My wife's been using natural CBD to cut down on pharmaceutical drug usage. It's helped my dog lose 50 pounds and play with essentially a bad hip with my other dog. And my father-in-law's lung cancer hasn't progressed because of CBD. So yeah, I'm a believer, though it's anecdotal and I'm not a scientist. I've seen what appears to be the wonders of it firsthand. And another anecdotal remark here is, you know, I was talking to a doctor client of ours, and he's still skeptical on its use and the results from it, but he said every one of his elderly patients are asking for it, you know, for medical purposes, of course.
And Ryan, we have had, of course, a great couple of weeks here in U.S. stocks. You look at the headlines, it doesn't look like it can get any better. Now, do you think based on that, that we're looking at a melt up in front of us, or is it more steady as she goes?
Well, I think, you know, we talked quite a bit about the economic numbers here, and then we also talked about how they could possibly drop here in the weeks, the month ahead, just due to Hurricane Florence. That tends to happen. But typically the market, when it sees things like that and you look, you read between the lines, you get the commentary on it where it's possible that a lot of that's coming from that storm and the results of it, then most economists in the market looks at it with a grain of salt. But, you know, the indices are just in great shape, minus the NASDAQ. And if you look at the NYSE FANG index, which I think it's, if I look at those two areas, I think it's profit-taking and really healthy, because concentration in those areas isn't healthy long-term. It's nice to see that it's spreading out to other areas, but I would like to see the NASDAQ break to new highs to confirm what we're seeing in the Dow Jones Industrials you know, finally breaking this week above those January highs. That's a great thing. While tech was really weak early in the week, there was some really bad days there. Higher yields have helped the financials to compensate for that weakness to kind of lift up stocks. The 10-year yield is testing the May highs near 3.1%, coming back a little bit Thursday and Friday. But mind you, next week, what do we got around the corner? Federal Reserve meeting, which is essentially, when I looked at federal fund futures, we're looking at about a 98% chance they're going to raise the federal fund futures 25 basis points. And the two-year, you know, if we look at the two-year spread versus the 10-year, it's still small. We're right around 26 basis points, but it is off the lows, and that's helping financials. Now, the 10-year yield is up 27 basis points from the lows in August, probably due to the removal of some of the flight to safety issues we saw that month, talking about Turkey's currency early in August. Italian budget difficulties are still going back and forth whether they're going to stay below that 3% threshold. And then there's the ongoing trade war. You know, Trump was announcing that the tariff on $200 billion in goods, and also talking about possibly going up well above that towards all of their goods. And then, of course, the effect on the trade war on what we're seeing in emerging market equities, Chinese market, et cetera. Now, the S&P financial sector is yet to break above its January highs, but appears to have confirmed technically a bottom this week, looking at essentially a 3% handle on that 10-year treasury. So short answer, yeah, steady as she goes.
Well, Ryan, since you started the report, I'm hearing phrases like bouncing back, higher yields, great shape. You know, if you keep giving us good news, we may have to have you in the studio more than once a week. But we do appreciate you coming by, Ryan. We'll look forward to that next report. Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
Beyond that, I do think there's a very good chance that the White House escalates that tariff threat after the midterm elections to include tariffs on the rest of Chinese imports into the U.S. And there's no avoiding broad consumer impact at that stage. Like right now, you have some product exclusions, mainly, you know, things that would be on your Christmas shopping list, like smartwatches and things like that. But either way, you are going to see a consumer impact, and most importantly, a big industrial impact, as you're seeing tariffs on, you know, a lot of precursor chemicals and industrial inputs that are raising costs overall.
Do you know the impact of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act to your personal finances? Are you a high-income earner, owner of multiple real estate holdings, or considering divorce? If you are, your taxes may be going up. Come to the Financial Sense Strategy and Wealth Preservation Conference by Jim Poplava and his special guest, Chris Hennessy, a tax lawyer and CPA, to explore what the new tax law will do to your finances. The conference will be held at the Hilton San Diego Hotel in Del Mar on October 27th. To learn more, go to www.financialsense.com for information on how you can register. That's www.financialsense.com. Seating is limited and going fast. Don't let filing your 2018 taxes give you a rude awakening. Be prepared now. Investment advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, usually when it comes to this time of the year, the markets are in a stormy mode. Well, it seems like the only storms are in the weather. Joining us on the program from Oppenheimer is Ari Wahl. Ari, let's begin with where the market is. From your perspective, you expect this bull market to continue. When it seems like we're going to have a hiccup, that doesn't happen. We hardly get any pullbacks other than maybe the one we got at the beginning of the year.
That's right, Jim. We have had the hiccup. We had the hiccup for the good part of the first half of the year. And now we're seeing signs that the bull market is resuming. We think this trend does continue. One key positive for us is that internal breadth in the U.S. is broader than many give it credit for. Typically, when many stocks are participating, that is a characteristic of a trend that should continue. And I think that's what's happening right now.
Up until this time, Ari, it has been a story about technology. Technology, consumer discretionary stocks have been leading. And up until recently, in fact, this week, the blue chip average like the Dow Industrials has been lagging. Transports were doing better than the industrials, but now the industrials are playing catch up. Is this a rotation into more conservative stocks? What is driving this?
Well, as we talk about this, important to note that leadership is a zero-sum game, that for every leader, there has to be a laggard. So for the first half of the year, we had and really for a better part of this cycle, a lot of leadership in growth-specific sectors like technology and consumer discretionary. Now, more recently, we have seen a little of the more kind of global cyclical plays like industrials and financials try to join the rally to a certain degree. I think it's important to note it's not that tech is selling off, that group is simply pausing. So I think this rotation that we've described here is the characteristic of a healthy bull market, that as one group leads, another group pauses, then as the leadership group pauses, that rotation just continues to shift around. And I think this is a key characteristic of this bull market and a key reason why we think it continues.
Now, you believe we have entered late cycle conditions, which have emerged in 2018. Explain that for our listeners, and what does that mean in terms of market rotations, sectors that move to the forefront and leadership?
That's right. So kind of taking a step back and talking about more of the big picture view here and the macro trends, I think what we're seeing in the yield curve does argue for more late cycle conditions, specifically the flattening of the yield curve. I think if you look at the shape of the yield curve, that's really been a key driver of the growth versus value ratio, that as the yield curve has flattened, that growth has outperformed. And we think that trend continues. We think that the short end of the yield curve should continue to rise based on tighter monetary policy expectations, while the long end of the yield curve should remain anchored by more subdued global growth concerns. I think with that in mind, that a premium should remain placed on higher growth companies in this low growth world, i.e., we think technology maintains its leadership. Now, I think this is especially true when you consider the bull market's age. Now, while a lot has been made about that this is the longest bull market ever, we disagree with that notion. In fact, we think that there was a bear market in the 2015 to 2016 period. Now, having said that, we are now approaching year three, considering that the bull market started in the first quarter of 2016, 2019 will be year three. But important to note that we're nearing year three of what is typically a three-year bull cycle. So the economy is maturing. The age of the bull market is maturing. However, late cycle doesn't mean end of cycle. We think these late cycle conditions can last for multiple quarters. So I think this is still consistent with a bull market that should continue. And that's why our favorite area, though, are some of these growthier sectors like technology.
Ari, one thing that has happened with as interest rates rise and as the Fed continues to raise interest rates, it's expected to raise interest rates next week and then once again in December. There was a saying called TINA, there is no alternative to stocks. But now we're starting to see the yields on treasury bills, the yields on cash rise. In your opinion, looking at where we are with interest rates, which you believe will continue to rise both on the short and long end, at what point does cash become a strong enough alternative to stocks, causing stocks to weaken?
Well, our view, I think this idea that there is no alternative, it speaks to the idea of that there's a level of interest rates out there that once it's reached, it makes cash and bond-like alternatives more attractive. We disagree with that notion. You know, for us and the indicators that we look at, it's the direction of interest rates, which is much more important. Specifically, that higher interest rates is consistent with firming economic backdrop, and that's typically the environment where stocks do best. Where alternatively, we'd be much more concerned with not with interest rates reaching a certain level, but to the point where they actually start to move lower. That if you look back at major equity market tops in the year 2000, 2007, and even 2015 as well, they all occurred consistent with a breakdown in interest rates. That is a signal of the bond market indicating that there's problems brewing. That would give us much more concern. We're not seeing that. We are seeing the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield hold its rising 200-day moving average. That average currently coming in at around 2.8%. As long as that support is intact, our inner market checks are healthy, and we think they argue for higher S&P 500 highs.
I want to talk about some inner market relationships that give us a clue in terms of where we are in the market. You believe 10-year Treasury yields should continue to trend higher. Of course, that is helping to strengthen the dollar. Let's talk about the dollar, interest rates, and commodities, because commodities are almost like a bifurcated market. If you look at gold, it has done terrible. If you look at copper, it's terrible. Industrial metals don't look good. However, if you look at oil, oil has really been looking strong this year.
That's right. So when talking about commodities, it's really important now to distinguish which commodity that we're talking about. If you were to look at the equal weighted commodity index, which puts an equal weighting on agricultural commodities, metals, as well as energy as well, it's been much weaker, that it's traded inverse to the dollar. Specifically, as the dollar has strengthened since the second quarter of this year, commodity prices, equal weighted commodity prices, have declined sharply. We think that correlation is going to continue. More recently, the dollar has softened to a certain degree through the course of the last month. And with that, commodities have bounced back. But in general, we're not expecting meaningful dollar weakness. And in turn, we're not expecting meaningful strength in commodity prices as a whole. The one that has bucked that trend has indeed been the price of oil. The price of oil has maintained a stronger trend throughout this. And for that reason, we still think that the price of oil remains well bid. It's been able to hold its rising 200-day moving average. That support level approaching around $67. So the takeaway for West Texas crude oil is that as long as you're above $67, the assumption is that that trend continues. That trend is higher as well, and in turn, we expect higher oil prices.
Let's talk about another intermarket relationship. You mentioned the trend in interest rates expected to go up, the dollar to remain strong. Let's talk about emerging markets. And do we get to any point, Ari, in your opinion, where trouble erupts in emerging market? And I'm just thinking of all those trillions of dollars of dollar-denominated debt that was taken on in this cycle by emerging markets. When does emerging markets become a problem for the U.S.?
That's a great question, and that is the biggest risk to our view. I led off saying that the key positive to our view is that internal breadth in the U.S. is broader than many give it credit for. However, the risk to our view, and probably what's given us the greatest concern, is that if you look at internal breadth globally, it's much weaker. Specifically, we have seen weakness not only in emerging markets, but in many of the developed market countries as well within Europe and Asia. So speaking in terms of emerging markets, that trend has broken. Now, we've received a lot of inquiries recently whether this is acting as an opportunity, if emerging markets are oversold and due to bounce back. Perhaps so, But that is not a recommendation that we can make. We think emerging markets need to stabilize further before they can really rally sustainably. So to answer your question, I don't know how long that bifurcation can last. For now, at the very least, it does confirm our ongoing preference for U.S. over world. If you're worried about that bifurcation, first thing you want to sell is your global equities, the equities that are causing it. But our hunch is that looking at strength in U.S. benchmarks like the Russell 2000, which is a proxy for small cap stocks, seeing strength there is leading us to believe that for now, the U.S. can buck that weakness.
Would, let's say, interest rates rising in a strengthening dollar, would that be a negative for stocks longer term? In other words, we know if you take a company like Coca-Cola, almost 80% of its revenues come from overseas. So if the dollar strengthens and other currencies weaken, that would harm revenues and profits.
That's right. So there's kind of two different themes going on there. First off, regarding interest rates, while we're making the case that rising interest rates, if they do continue to rise, that would actually be a net positive for stocks, it would be a negative for stocks with a high dividend that act like bond proxies, like a Coca-Cola. The more countercyclical stocks in the market, not only in Coca-Cola, look at consumer staples as a whole. For that reason, we do see risk in consumer staples. It's one of our least favorite sectors. We do expect it to underperform while the rest of the market acts better. Speaking in terms of the dollar, while we're not expecting a parabolic move higher in the dollar, which would be concerning, that's what we saw in 2014, 2015, a surging dollar that really led to some disruptions. If you do see continued dollar strength, that would act as a headwind for more global equities like those in the material sector. It would be a headwind for emerging markets. So again, it also, with that in mind, it's a key reason why we do have a preference for more U.S.-centric investments right here.
And I want to talk about something that's going to take place at the end of the month is when they reconfigure a lot of these indexes, you're going to have a communications service sector that'll be the fourth largest sector in the market within the various industries. They're going to take some of the tech stocks, put them in there, some of the media stocks. They're going to reduce the technology sector. It'll look more like industrial type technology, hardware makers. Do you see any disruption as a result of those changes as indexes have to sell groups in, let's say, one index and then they have to buy them in another? Any disruption or volatility as a result?
I don't expect much disruption there. They are going to rename the telecom sector. Communication services are going to add stocks from the technology and consumer discretionary sectors. However, a lot of the institutional portfolio managers that traffic in those stocks are the ones that are going to continue to traffic in those stocks. In general, their benchmark is TMT as a whole. And while previously they were put in different sectors, for the most part, it was still included in their overall universe. So I think the changes are going to be the newly renamed telecom sector is going to be act a bit more like a growth sector rather than traditionally a more valued, high dividend bond-like sector. Looking at technology and discretionary, we don't expect much change in their behavior either. While the composition will change and you're going to see some of the big names coming out of those groups, the reason why we don't expect their behavior to change is the same reason why we're positive on those two sectors. That is that they're not only strong in cap-weighted terms, but they've also been strong in equally weighted terms, where if you take out a few stocks, even though they might be big parts of the cap-weighted composition, the fact that the sectors have still acted as leadership in equal-weighted terms, we don't expect much change there. And at the end of the day, technology is still going to be dominated by Apple and Microsoft, two stocks we like. And in turn, we don't think technology is going to change because of that. And at the end of the day, discretionary cap weighted is still going to be influenced heavily and dominated by Amazon and Home Depot, two stocks that are acting strong in our work. And in turn, we think discretionary continues to act strong as well.
I want to talk about another catalyst that we've seen in the markets this year. This year is a record year for M&A activity, exceeding the peak in 2000 and 2007. But Ari, it's also a record year for stock buybacks. Normally, they've been averaging somewhere in the neighborhood of $400 or $500 billion a year. They're talking this year somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 trillion. How much of that is helping this market?
I don't know if it's had much of an influence, because as much as the numbers have continued to grow and we're seeing increased M&A activity, the actual stocks where that's taking place, they've been underperforming versus the market. Take, for instance, if you look at the S&P 500 buyback index, I suppose as M&As have increased through the year, this index has actually underperformed. So it's tough to make the case that is making a significant, acting as a significant tailwind for the market when those stocks are actually underperforming versus the overall market.
So as you, from your perch right now, as you look at, and especially as we head into the end of the year, where we always seem to get that what we call Santa Claus rally, a very strong finish as we head into December, you like, from what you're looking at, technology, healthcare, and consumer discretionary. Anything outside those three sectors that looks good to you? And if it is a sector, do you just buy the sector, or is it more company specific?
Well, those would be the three sectors where we're seeing the broadest amount of strength throughout the group, that they score very high in our momentum work as well. But the saying goes, a rising tide lifts all boats. And I think as the bull market continues here, and as seasonals become a tailwind, and I think what we're gearing up for one of these typical year-end rallies, I think you can broaden your exposure beyond that. Next in our list would be energy, financials, industrials, utilities, and the new communication services group. Within those, we'd say perhaps key more on industry selection, be a little bit more selective. The three sectors where we'd be most cautious on and we would say to stay away from would be materials, consumer staples, and REITs, for the same reasons that we do expect the dollar to continue to strengthen to pressure the material sector, and for rates to continue to move higher to pressure staples and the REIT sectors. Those would be the groups to stay away from.
A final question, if I may, as the Fed raises interest rates, which is widely expected, you expect long-term rates to rise as well. What point do you see money start to come out of the bond market? When you look at some of the bond funds, LQD, TLT, all the popular ones that a lot of investors, especially retail investors, have put a lot of money in, when does that money start coming out and finding its way into the stock market?
Yeah, the great rotation, which I think this idea and the question, that question has been asked now for years. So just goes to show how difficult to answer that question is. I mean, this was a big topic, I think, about a decade ago, and we really still haven't seen it fall through into the flows of the market. So I don't know when exactly, but in terms of price action, it does look like that the equity should continue to outperform versus bonds. That I have a little bit more conviction in versus when the actual flip will occur in terms of the flows from the one asset to the other.
All right. As we close, if our listeners would like to follow the great work that you do, how could they do so?
Listeners can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Ari Wald.
Well, Ari, thanks so much for joining us on the program. Have yourself a great weekend and come back and talk to us again.
Thank you, Jim. You too.
Bye-bye.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
We know that that unconscious brain drives our behavior much more predictably than the rational brain. So what we've studied is we've studied all these cognitive biases that we have, which are driven by our unconscious. In fact, today the list is very long. To my knowledge, there is 188 registered known cognitive biases. And they come from the fact that we don't use our smart brain, we use our primitive brain to make these decisions. Now, most people that are in sales and marketing, you know, dealing with the list of 188, it's very complicated. So what we've done is we've narrowed it down to 6 stimuli. In other words, these 188 rules of how irrational we are can be summarized in 6 rules of what we call stimulus.
Well, the commodity markets have not been doing well this year. It turns out it's a bifurcated market. When you want to speak about commodities, you need to talk about which one in particular, which is what we're going to do now, the oil markets. Joining me on the program is Robert Rapier. Robert, as we begin our discussion, I want to talk about a new bill and law that goes into effect in 2020 that's really going to impact the transportation system, and that is maritime shipping, where they have dropped the sulfur content of diesel fuel to 0.5 from roughly 3.5. You know, there's over 60,000 ships that ply the ocean. Let's talk about diesel and the impact of this new bill.
Okay, yeah. So what's going to happen is on January the 1st, 2020, the International Maritime Organization is going to require the sulfur content in marine fuel to drop from 3.5% down to 0.5%. And right now, high sulfur fuels, that is an outlet for them. They can go into the marine fuel, and that's going to change. And right now, it's questionable whether there is going to be enough low sulfur fuel oil supply to supply that market. We've got a bit of an analogy when, the countries have been tightening sulfur specs for years to try to combat acid rain. And so back in the middle of the last decade, we began to phase in ultra low sulfur diesel. And when that happened, we had gone a long period where gasoline traded at a premium to diesel. But to meet the ultra low sulfur diesel standards, refineries had to invest billions of dollars to remove that sulfur. And I was actually working at a refinery then. We had to put in hydrotreaters. And what happened was, after that transition, diesel has been consistently more expensive than gasoline. And if you look over the last 20 years, you can see that. In fact, I plotted that for an article in Forbes. From 94 to 2004, gasoline was consistently maybe 10 to 20 cents higher than diesel. And since 2005, the spec went in 2006, diesel has been consistently more expensive than gasoline and sometimes significantly more expensive. I mean, it has spiked to 50, 60 cents more expensive per gallon.
So when you look at this, and ships are either going to have scrubbers or they're going to have to be using this low sulfur diesel, let's talk about the refiners. How many refiners are set up to handle this new fuel requirement?
Well, a lot of them have been putting in the equipment. It's just a matter of capacity. And so a lot of them can handle it. They just may not be able to handle the volumes. And so what you will probably see is more of a premium on low sulfur crude oils, because that's where the sulfur comes from in the first place. You got high sulfur crudes that a lot of these refiners love to process because they get very good margins in cleaning up the heavy sour crudes and turning them into finished products. The margins on those are extremely good. But for those that don't have the capacity, they're going to have to buy, I think, more of the light sweet crudes. And you may see some of the price differential widen even between the light sweet crudes and the heavy sour crude.
What does this translate in terms of energy companies? Because we know if you take a look at shale oil, a lot of that is light sweet crude. It's the better kind of variety to make this kind of fuel versus, let's say, heavy sulfur crude, as you get in some other places around the globe and the oil companies that basically find it.
Yeah, it's probably good for the shale oil producers because that is pretty light sweet crude. I expect to see those prices come up a little bit. It's good for refiners, especially those that can export. They can put this fuel. I think the global diesel prices are going to spike, and anybody like a Valero that has coastal refineries and can put that diesel out on the open market, I think they'll benefit.
I want to talk about there's two or three stories that are making its way through the oil markets. Number one, we are going to be hitting peak demand in the next decade because of the introduction of electric cars. That's number one. Number two, if the price of oil spikes or goes over 80 or 90, OPEC's capacity to really produce more oil, in particular Saudi Arabia. Robert, I have never seen Saudi Arabia, at least I've never read in BP statistics or any other report, where they've gone much over 10.6, 10.8. Certainly, we've never seen them produce the 12.5 million barrels that they claim that they can produce.
Yeah, that's true. I think as this Iranian oil comes off the market, as we go follow through with sanctions here, there's going to be tremendous pressure to fill that void. And I don't think OPEC, the rest of OPEC, can easily do it. So you've seen the market sort of realize that, and you've seen prices spike up to more than $70 a barrel for West Texas Intermediate. Now, they backed off a little bit today because President Trump came out and said, OPEC, you've got to put more oil out there and get these prices down. And I guess enough people believe that they can do it, that prices did come down a little bit today. But I don't think that's likely. I don't think if Iran has a million barrels a day come off the market, that anybody can easily step up and fill that gap, especially considering that oil consumption is going to continue to grow at more than a million barrels a day. Even some of these reports that are forecasting peak demand, they're saying, yes, that will continue for, IHS Market. There was an IHS Market report that came out recently, and they said, yes, oil demand will probably peak in the 2030s. But between now and then, they expect demand to go up by 1.1 million barrels a day through 2030. So, you know, we're going to need another 15 million barrels a day between now and then. And so the longer that Iranian oil is off the market and demand continues to grow and existing fields deplete, there's a significant risk of an oil price spike.
And if we do get that oil price spike, and the reason I want to bring this up, one of the characteristics, Robert, if you look at recessions over, let's say, the last half century, two characteristics were rising interest rates and rising oil prices. Just go back to 2007, you go back to 2000, go back to 1991. All these recessions were characterized by rising interest rates and rising oil prices. If prices were to spike as a result of a million barrels taken off the market of Iranian oil, do you think the president would maybe change his tune, or we would find something? Because already he made another comment. He doesn't like the price of oil rising. We're heading into a midterm election. On the day you and I are doing this interview, we've got the price of oil at close to over $70 a barrel.
Yeah, and unless he blinks on the Iranian sanctions, I don't think he's got a lot of power to influence. You know, he can try to talk the price down. If Democrats take the House, he can start pointing fingers at them and say, yeah, they're the reason that this happened. But, there's just not a lot of spare capacity out there in the world right now. And so, there will be real implications here from this oil coming off the market.
If that oil comes off the market and it does spike, let's talk about the possibilities that somebody comes up with the extra oil. We've got shale oil production, which continues to rise, so that's a possibility. But outside of U.S. shale and maybe a little bit more from Saudi Arabia or maybe Russia, where does the extra oil come from?
Well, back to the IHS Market report, they think most of the new global oil supplies over the next decade, 70%, they think, will come from the U.S., Canada, and Brazil, and most of that from the U.S. You know, Saudi Arabia may be sitting on a little bit of spare capacity, but not a lot. And I think if they try to step in and fill that void from Iran, they will be completely tapped out. And I don't think they want to do that. I don't think they want to get in a position where, you know, there's absolutely no spare capacity in the market. So, there are a few places, but, you know, even in the U.S. right now, they are starting to ramp down expectations. You know, the Energy Information Administration is starting to decrease the estimates for growth in the future. And part of that is because of the Permian Basin constraints. If you look, Permian Basin oil production, which has grown so strongly, has outstripped the ability to get that oil out of there. And so you're seeing a leveling off of production there. I think next year they're going to get some new pipelines in. I think you'll see growth resume. But, you know, it hasn't been a straight line up like maybe was forecast a couple of years ago.
And we've got trade barriers going into effect this week. The president slapped tariffs on over $200 billion worth of goods. China slapped tariffs on $60 billion of goods that we ship to them. What are the possibilities? Let's take three scenarios. You've got a trade war that escalates. You could have rising oil prices and rising interest rates. I would submit, Robert, the combination of those three would not be good for economic growth.
Yeah, absolutely correct. I mean, the market is signaling rising risks right now. Volatility is increasing. Bond prices are climbing as people, you know, flee into safer havens that they view as safer havens. I see the risks going up. You know, it's funny enough, though, China knows how dependent they are on oil. So they had given a waiver that they originally threatened to put sanctions on U.S. oil, which we're actually exporting oil to China now. And they decided maybe that's not such a good idea. You know, they may change their mind in the future. But, you know, the last time oil prices spiked, you know, the one industry that does quite well is the oil industry. I mean, that is a place to be when oil prices spike, unless, as happened in 2008, they spiked so high that they caused a recession. And then you saw prices totally collapse. But, you know, they did recover. You know, in 2008, prices spiked up to, you know, $150. And they fell back in the 30s by the end of the year. So that was a really sharp spike and decline. But they climbed back up to $100 within a year because the supply-demand fundamentals were there. And oil demand is inelastic enough that, you know, regardless of what the price was, people had to have it. Between like the fall in 2008 and 2014, I think oil outperformed most sectors of the S&P 500. Oil companies had a bull market right until the oil price crash of 2014. We may very well see that again, regardless of recession. You know, there may be some demand slowdown, but there's enough risk in supply in the market that, you know, even if there's a little bit of a slowdown, we may still be pretty tight. If you look, inventories are still coming down. They're coming down around the world. They're coming down in the U.S. And, you know, that signals that the market needs a little bit more oil.
I want to talk about something that's going on within the industry itself that bodes well for higher oil prices down the road. During the downturn after 2014, oil companies slashed their capital expenditure budgets. A recent report just came out by the EIA saying that of the major oil companies, they have reduced their debt for seven consecutive quarters running. Cash flow has increased tremendously. $119 billion in the four quarters ending in June. In a lot of that, these companies, Robert, have not been using to, let's say, increase production, explore for more oil. They've been very disciplined. They've raised their dividends. They're paying down their debt structures, as the EIA just mentioned, seven quarters in a row. What does this mean down the road? As you mentioned, if oil demand is going up by 1.1 million barrels a day, the major oil companies are not investing in new projects or cutting back expenditures. What is this going to mean 3 or 4 years from now or 5 years from now?
Yeah, in 3 years, there's going to be, you know, 1 or 2 million barrels a day not on the market that would have been on the market had oil prices remained high. You know, this is always the way it goes. When prices fall, companies slash capital budgets and they leave them cut long enough that eventually when oil prices go back up, they're not in position to capitalize as much as they would have. But you've seen really all these companies tighten their belts. You know, I'm looking at ConocoPhillips cash flow right now. It has rebounded strongly over the last 12 months. It's more than double what it was in 2016. You see this consistently across oil companies. Many of them have now recovered and are making as much cash flow as they were before the crash. But that comes at the at the price of lower expenditures, lower capital expenditures. That's going to cause a problem down the road. They will benefit from spiking prices, but they don't have crystal balls either. I remind people about this all the time. You know, they're guessing. They're looking at futures prices. They're looking into their crystal balls, and they're making guesses on where oil prices are going to be. And if they knew that oil prices were going to be $100 in 2020, you would see everyone raising capital expenditures.
You know, this is something that you have written about recently, in that oil remain a large viable industry well into the future, because you have, you know, you take a look at all the technological changes that we've seen, our smartphones, we have electric cars now. And everybody is saying that, you know, I just don't see, Robert, given the cost of electric cars, plus the fact that we don't have an infrastructure. I mean, I drive to Arizona frequently. It's this 5.5-6 hour drive. But, you know, I'm able to stop off at a gas station, two stops, spend 5 minutes, fill my tank, and I'm on my way. If I have an electric car, I'm not sure I can do that. In other words, there's not enough charging stations. And if there were, do I really want to go into a charging station and wait 45 minutes for my batteries to charge?
Yeah, exactly. That's all coming, but it's not going to come as quickly as, you know, maybe Bloomberg in 2015 wrote an article about how, you know, peak demand was possible by 2022. And they were forecasting that electric vehicles were going to take huge amounts of market share away from oil. And in fact, oil demand now is, you know, 3 million barrels a day higher than when they wrote that report. And they were forecasting that it would be in decline, you know, flattening out by now. And in fact, demand is growing as fast as it ever has. And that's why, even though demand is likely to start slowing, it's going to be another decade before that happens. So oil companies are going to still need to be out there investing in projects. They're going to be needing to make up for depleting oil fields. That's, you know, the electric vehicle revolution. I believe it's going to happen. It's just not going to happen as quickly as, you know, some of the optimists felt like it would. And I think that's reflected in the IHS market report. They believe that, you know, eventually electric vehicles will take over. But, you know, they looked at all the trends and they said, you know, it's not going to really take a big bite until the 2030s.
So let's take a look at this from the investment side. We can take a look at XLE, the oil ETF. It is doing fairly well for the year. And then you take a look at some companies, Robert, that have made major investments. And I'm thinking of one of the large cap stocks like Exxon, who announced that they're going to invest $50 billion here in U.S. They've been sort of penalized because the oil market is looking for companies that are buying back stock, raising dividends, and paying back debt versus companies like Exxon, which are making major expenditures. So how do you play this market?
Well, so funny enough, I'm writing articles right now for Investing Daily, where I talk about big oil and I look at all the companies, and I talk about ExxonMobil, and they've had a few stumbles. I mean, it's not just that they're being penalized for that. You know, if you look at the last decade, a company like Chevron has consistently outperformed ExxonMobil. A lot of people don't realize that, but if you track the two stocks over the last 10 years, last 20. Chevron is consistently doing better than ExxonMobil. Some of that is because ExxonMobil, you know, bought XTO, that natural gas company, when natural gas prices were high and looked like they were going to go much higher. So they overpaid for that. So some of the smaller, you know, big oil companies have outmaneuvered ExxonMobil. I think Shell is, you know, when I looked at the value in the super majors, I think Shell looks like the best value. They are really positioning themselves to benefit from what looks to be like a major growth in LNG around the world. And so I think Shell, which, you know, 10 years ago I didn't like because they had to write down reserves and, you know, had some issues. I think now they look positioned to be to do very well. If you recall, you know, last year I was talking about BP a lot. I said, you know, I didn't like BP as a company a decade ago because I felt like they were a bit lax on their safety. And that was before the Deepwater Horizon incident. But eventually, their market cap got slashed so low. And when the liabilities sort of became known, I started saying, look, you know, regardless of what you think about BP as a company, that there's a value here that is undeniable. And BP has outperformed all of the other super majors over the last year. They have the highest return of all. And so, you know, another one that I like and I've talked about a lot is ConocoPhillips. That's my largest holding. ConocoPhillips is up 54% over the last year. So the pure oil producers have done very well. The natural gas producers have not done as well. And I think they're due for a rise. Big Oil as a group has done well. I mean, they're as a group, they're up nearly 20% as a group over the past year. And that's, you know, they're being dragged down some by ExxonMobil's performance. And midstreams are still, I think, lagging. And despite the fact that they're, you know, they're covering cash flow, they've got really good yields, they are still underperforming the market. And they look like the most undervalued sector among the sectors of the oil and gas industry.
So if you were to play this market, Robert, would you be, let's say, company specific, or do you think investors could do just as well by buying, let's say, an energy ETF?
Yeah, I always prefer to spread my bets out a little bit. Unless you have a large portfolio and you want to buy, putting five, you know, into five different like midstream companies, maybe would be a not too significant portion of your portfolio. You can do it that way. But alternatively, yes, you can buy an ETF. I'd certainly look at the midstreams. I think that it's just a matter of time before they come back. I think natural gas, we're setting up there's a real disconnect setting up right now because natural gas inventories are below the five-year average. They're 20% below where they were a year ago, and we're headed into winter. And if we have a cold winter, like right now, NYMEX price for natural gas in January is still just $3. There's a significant risk there that is not being priced in the market. We may go through and have a mild winter and everything is fine, but the risks of having a natural gas shortfall by the end of the winter are significantly higher than they were, and that is not reflected in the price. And natural gas companies have just not performed well at all. Many of them are producing, you know, decent cash flow, but they're being punished because the price of natural gas has languished between $2.50 and $3.
All right. Well, listen, Robert, as we close, you write at a number of publications. You write for Forbes, Investors Daily. You also have a couple newsletters. Tell our listeners, if they would like to find out more about the work you can do, where can they find you?
Sure. So I write 7 columns a month for Forbes, and you can find them under Forbes Energy page. I cover the entire energy market, but I usually focus on oil and gas. I also have taken over Investing Daily's utility forecaster, which is not specifically utilities, but it covers the utility space. This month, I'm adding Big Oil to those portfolios because the yields are consistent with, you know, it's basically an income portfolio that I manage for them and income offerings that we cover. The yields on the Big Oil companies are significantly better than something like a water utility, and they're fairly safe. So that's one of the things I've done is start to shift a little more energy companies into that portfolio. So that's at Investing Daily.
All right. Well, listen, Robert, as always, thanks for joining us on the program. Have yourself a great weekend.
All right. Thanks for having me, Jim.
We do want to thank you for listening to this first part of the Financial Sense NewsHour. Do stay tuned for Hour 2, The Big Picture. We're going to be examining periodic episodes of bubbles in a particular asset class or market sector. And it's something we're really seeing a lot during this bull market. So we're going to be discussing why flash crashes and flash bubbles are becoming more common, and we'll look at the catalyst for the next bear market and recession. Also covered are worker shortages and the tightening of the U.S. labor market. So do stay tuned for Hour 2, Flash Crashes and Flash Bubbles on The Big Picture.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.